City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program, video streaming live and broadcasting from our studios in New York City. Today, the latest on health and healing, some brand new information that you have not heard about, because I just read it this morning in a major scientific peer-reviewed journal. An article entitled The Self-Organized Criticality Theory of Autoimmunity. Know what that means? You will, and why it impacts all the people listening a little later on in our show. From our commentary section, Becoming a Third World Country from John Michael Greer. From our environmental segment, something I warned about when I was filming on the Mississippi this year. The Mississippi River is drying up. How dry? Within the next 12 months, there may be no ships, boats, barges able to get up or down the Mississippi. What would that mean? I'll tell you about that. From our investigative reporting file, the media coverage of Syria, including those on the left, well, according to a nun, Patsy McGrary, it is biased. Much of it is slanted, we'll tell you that. Then, from our Human Nature series, this is a new series, I'm going to take a look in my own commentary that I've written last night on what it means to be the 90 million of us who are over the age of 47, we are going from middle age to senior citizen status. What can we do to rejuvenate our lives? What can we do to become relevant again? What can we do to be active in the solutions of our society? And for all of you who are younger than 47, and you want to know, how did we get to where we are at? I'll explain that as well. You won't want to miss that commentary. It is called Our Dilemma. So that's what we have for you today. I will be taking calls about 25 minutes from now after I've done my commentary. And then you can do a talkback segment and share your points of view. We always begin with something that can help everyone in the world. And it's fun to see all the emails that come in from all over the world. For example, clove. Now, clove is grown almost everywhere. It's a universal nutrient. Here's what most people are not aware of, and this is from a Hernandez University researcher. It says, clove is the best antioxidant spice. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Flavor and Fragrance Journal. I'll quote this. Using spices eaten in the Mediterranean diet as natural antioxidants is a good way to improve your health. A group of scientists at Miguel Hernandez University have identified cloves as the best antioxidant spice due to the fact they contain high levels of phenolic compounds as well as other properties. Quote, out of the five antioxidant properties tested, cloves had the highest capacity to give off hydrogen, reduced lipid peroxidation, and was the best iron reducer. The results show that the use of the natural antioxidants occurring in spices used in the Mediterranean diet or their extracts is a viable option for the food industry, as long as the characteristics of the food product are not affected, meaning if you overcook it, it'd be affected. Now, I would suggest, and they also measured oregano, thyme, rosemary, and sage. Well, unfortunately, they're wrong. Clove is great, so I'm not suggesting you shouldn't use clove. They didn't measure cinnamon. Cinnamon is, by way higher standards, the best antioxidant, has the highest ORAC value, probably 10 times that of clove. Now, also, they measured oregano, and it wouldn't be accurate to say that oregano shouldn't be considered because it doesn't have the same antioxidant. What oregano has are oils that are broad spectrum. It is one of nature's most perfect natural antibiotics. I don't care what kind of virus or bacteria or parasite you have in your body. When you take wild oregano oil, you're helping to kill it off without killing the natural cells in the body. So what they should have done, in my opinion, is they should have looked at each one of the unique properties, and instead of comparing them all to an antioxidant standard, say, which one is the best at killing bacteria, viruses, which is the best at stopping oxidative stress, which is the best that has phenolic acids that are terrific at lowering cholesterol. But it was still good to know that clove is that important. There were two scientists that I had the privilege of meeting early in my career when I was very young. One was Dr. Hans Selye, and he was the person who told us about distress versus stress. Stress is a normal part of life, and it's not destructive. It's when it becomes distress that it is. And he talked about what happens in the body when you become distressed. Then after that, there was a Dr. Lawrence Lachan, a man who I knew because we both worked at the Institute of Applied Biology. He is a senior scientist, and I was just a novice at the time. But he had written some very important books, and we had a chance to sit and talk at length on some of these issues. He said that he could take 500 women, and he did, who had no history of breast cancer in their family, and determine over the next 20 years who would get breast cancer just based upon how they reacted to stress. And he wrote about this extensively. And he said that the woman who feels underappreciated or unappreciated is most likely to end up with cancer of the breast. Later, there was the head of director of New York City's health department, Gerald, who came by the Institute all the time. I can't tell you how many conversations we had. He was particularly interested in how well I was doing helping persons with AIDS-defining illnesses. And though he acknowledged that the therapies were working, he also acknowledged that it was as much political as anything, and there was only so far that he could open a door to alternative approaches before politically it got closed because of all the money involved. In any case, he also said that he had a study showing how many people are going to get breast cancer with no other risk factors, no smoking or drinking, no cancer, based upon stress. So I had three different people tell me within a 10-year period and show me studies that they had done. Now jump ahead. This is the latest. This is from the University of Illinois at Chicago, the School of Public Health. This is from a Dr. Rasher. Here's what it says. Link between stress and breast cancer is found. Quote, we found that after diagnosis, black and Hispanic breast cancer patients reported higher levels of stress than whites, and that stress was associated with tumor aggressiveness. End quote. And they used almost 1,000 breast cancer patients and determined their levels of stress. Quote, those who reported higher levels of stress had more aggressive tumors. Now, they still didn't go back. I looked at the scientific paper. They didn't use any of this earlier pioneering work. In fact, no one has. It was as if it just fell out of interest. I think it would be important for someone in this audience. We have a lot of professionals in this audience, scientists, writers. Last night, when I went up to have a juice late last night, I ran into an award-winning artist in the New York Times who's worked the Times for 35 years. And we had a nice conversation. And we have a lot of people who have the capacity to do research. Why doesn't someone in this audience go back and find the work of Hans Selye and Lawrence Lachan and others who could show who's going most likely get cancer because of their distress levels, and then do an article on that, then do another article on how de-stressing techniques yoga, prayer, meditation, affirmations, mindful living, all these wonderful things that we can do daily can prevent that distress from being carcinogenic, because you're dealing with cortisol. Cortisol is your stress hormone. And when it's elevated, and especially when it's chronically elevated at low levels, it's the kind of distress that we live with when we're not happy, when we don't know who we are, when we're confused about issues, when we're afraid of losing something. So it's not the kind of manic stress, but rather it's low level, but it's there. That is what's going to age you prematurely. That distress is what kills you. Then write about that and submit it. Send it over to me here, and I'll be happy to read it on the air. And we'll put it up in, on our website, which is read by millions of people. So I'd like to get that out. I just don't have the time. I'm writing three new scripts for documentaries I'm going to be starting next year. And it takes a while to get this done. So I don't have any more time at this moment, but that's certainly something for someone in this audience to do. Now, I mentioned yesterday about the importance of the omega-3 fatty acids. You can get them either through walnut oil, avocados, almonds, flaxseed, which is one of your best, or you can get them by having fish oils. Here's the reason, once again, you have to get your omega-3 fatty acids, whichever form you choose. Omega-3 fatty acids may ward off heart disease. This is from Medical News Today. It says, most people, quote, whether healthy or having cardiovascular disease, would benefit from regular consumption of oily fish. And that's from a major conference. While eating whole fish undoubtedly offers the optimum approach for increasing omega-3 intake in both primary and secondary prevention, supplements have a major role to play in increasing the omega-3 intake for people who do not like fish. Quote, a fish a day keeps the doctor away, centered on the cardiovascular disease benefits, the long-chain, high unsaturated omega-3 fatty acids and EPA and DHA found in the flesh of oily fish such as salmon, mackerel, herring, trout, and sardines. By the way, the healthiest of those would be the sardines. So one more reason to have your omega-3 fatty acids. Also, for people who can get your hands on some organic coca, here's the reason why you should have it. Chocolate. Quote, University of Reading in England. The health benefits of polyphenols from coca have been gathering increased volume in the now there is the newest study that shows the cardiovascular and skin health, even brain health. The majority of the science into the potential benefits of coca have revolved around cardiovascular benefits of the flavanols, also called catechins, and particularly the monomeric flavanol, epicatechin. However, recent scientific studies have shown that it also improves gut microflora and possesses prebiotic potential. For the new analysis, German-based scientists investigated the effects of epicatechin dose on blood pressure in a randomized controlled trial, and it showed that the coca lowered blood pressure and produces good floral benefit. And for those mothers out there with your new child, from McMaster University, babies' brains benefit from music lessons. Quote, after completing the first study of its kind, researchers at McMaster University have discovered that very early musical training benefits children even before they can walk or talk. They found that one-year-old babies who participate in interactive music classes with their parents smile more, communicate better, and show earlier and more sophisticated brain responses to music. The findings were published in the scientific journals Developmental Science as well as the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. Quote, many past studies of musical training have focused on older children. Our results suggest that the infant brain might be particularly plastic with regard to musical exposure. So that's good. And also two more health studies. One again on the flavonoids. You know, when you eat the onion, oranges, grapefruit, flavonoids may block a blood clot. This is from the Journal of Clinical Investigations. This was done at Beth Israel Medical Center at Harvard Medical School. Quote, consumption of flavonoid rutin, either in foods or supplements, could help prevent the formation of blood clots. The study published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation reveals that the compound that is commonly found in fruits and vegetables, in addition to being sold as a dietary supplement, could have promise in blocking the formation of blood clots. Okay, let me just see. What's one of the best sources of flavonoids? Onions. Ah, didn't I just talk about that last week? An onion a day keeps a stroke away. A stroke, blood clots, dissolving the blood clots, preventing them from clumping together. This study, flavonoids may block blood clots and hence prevent stroke. And finally, soybeans soaked in warm water naturally release key cancer-fighting substances. And this is from Science Daily, from the Journal of Agriculture and Food Chemistry. Here's what it says, quote, soybeans soaking in warm water could become a new green source for production of a cancer-fighting substance. And by the way, this was done, these are the water at 122 degrees Fahrenheit. It naturally releases large amounts of BBI that can easily be harvested from the water. The protein appeared to be active, with tests showing that it stopped breast cancer cells from dividing in the laboratory dish. Quote, the abundance of BBI in soybean seed exudates by incubating the seeds in warm water provides a simple and alternative method to isolate this low molecular weight protein, end quote. And this was done at the Agricultural Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Now think of what they've been doing for a long time in China and Japan. Soaking soybeans. And so they're way ahead of that one. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we go to our environmental segment of our program, and I want to give something really interesting because this is, I'll give you the source. This is the Department of Biophysics, Kobe University Graduate School of Health Sciences, Kobe, Japan, and also the Department of Medicine in the School of Medicine, as well as the Center for Rheumatic Disease and the Global Center for Excellence in Tokyo, Japan. This was published in a peer-reviewed journal. It's called the Phase 1 Journal, which is a major and respected journal. Now, it's going to be a little technical now, but I'll tell you what it means. Quote, conclusions and significance. This is, listen carefully to this. Systemic autoimmunity appears to be the inevitable consequence of overstimulating the host's immune system by repeated immunization with antigen to the levels that suppress system self-organized criticality. All right. What does that mean in lay language? Vaccines. All vaccines. Systemic autoimmunity appears to be the inevitable consequence of overstimulating the host's immune system by repeated immunization with antigen. For example, when you get a measles, you're getting an antigen. Smallpox, an antigen. Polio, you're getting an antigen. And the levels then suppress the system's self-organized criticality, which means that homeostasis, the natural immunity, is disrupted. So this is a major challenge to everything that we thought was right about vaccinations, and yet not a word about this anywhere. But this is from the actual scientific study. And you have to understand autoantibodies, and you have to understand the immune system to understand why this is so critical. Because I've been saying all along, they have no critical data showing that a person who did not get a disease after vaccinated it because it was the vaccine that prevented the disease. There's multiple factors that can keep a person from having that. But it is true that people get vaccines also can have a destruction to their immune system, which makes them far more vulnerable to illnesses later in life. And this is one more proof of that. Now to our environmental segment. When I'm getting up very early in the morning, and I get up at 4, and down on the Mississippi, I go for a run. It's quiet. Generally around 3 o'clock, everything closes up, and so there's just total stillness. And when you're running by the Mississippi, and you hear the water splashing up, especially where the Mississippi enters the Gulf, it's pretty wide there. And there's just something very calming about that. And then about 4 hours later, I'm out there set up and I'm filming that for a particular documentary. And I kept looking at the water line. So I filmed the water line and then I asked one of the local guys, I said, how long has it been since that water line was there? The man looks, he said, last year. I said, you mean the Mississippi has dropped that much in just 1 year? He said, yeah. He said, it's bad. How bad is it? And why should you know this? Let me quote this from economiccollapseblog.com. The Mississippi is drying up is the article, and I'm posting it on my site for you to read today. Quote, the worst drought in more than 50 years is having a devastating impact on the Mississippi River. The Mississippi has become very thin and very narrow, and if it keeps on dropping, there's a very real possibility that all river traffic could get shut down. And considering the fact that approximately 60% of all of our grain, 22% of our oil and natural gas, and one-fifth of all the coal travel down the Mississippi River, that would be absolutely crippling for our economy. It's been estimated that if all Mississippi River traffic was stopped, it would cost the U.S. economy $300 million a day. So far, most of the media coverage of this historic drought has focused on the impact that it's having on farmers and ranchers. But the health of the Mississippi River is also absolutely crucial to the economic success of this nation. And right now, the Mississippi is in incredibly bad shape. This is a catastrophe. In some areas, the river is almost 20 feet below normal, and the water is expected to continue to drop. If we have another 12 months of weather ahead, similar to what we have had over the past 12 months, then the mighty Mississippi is going to be a complete and total disaster zone by this time just 12 months from now. Most Americans simply do not understand how vitally important the Mississippi River is to all of us. If the Mississippi River continues drying up to the point where commercial travel is no longer possible, it would be absolutely devastating to the U.S. economy. Unfortunately, vast stretches of the river are already dangerously low. The following is an excerpt from a transcript of a CNN report aired just 3 days ago. Two days ago. Quote, you might think this is some kind of desert just outside of Memphis, Tennessee. It's not. I'm actually standing on the exposed bottom of the Mississippi River. That's how dramatic the drop impact is being felt here. Hard to believe, a year ago we were talking about record flooding. Now they're worried about a new kind of record, record low. The river was 3 miles wide here. It's now down to 0.3 mile. It's lost 90% of its width. And that's causing all kinds of problems. A lot of stuff we use goes up and down the Mississippi River. We're talking about steel, coal, ore, grain. The problem is now a lot of those barges have had to lighten their loads, and even doing that, they are still running aground. End quote. It really is amazing that last year we were talking about historic flooding along the Mississippi, and this year we're talking about the Mississippi simply drying up. Now, there are some areas along the Mississippi that are already 20 feet below normal. This is another one of those. Quote, just outside of Memphis, the river is 13 feet below normal depth, while the National Weather Service says Vicksburg, Mississippi is 20 feet below normal levels. Overall, the Mississippi is 13 feet below normal averages for this time of year. And the drying up of the river is forcing barges, tugboats, and towboats operators to navigate narrower and more shallow spots in the river, slowing their speeds as they pass dangerously close to one another. In some parts of the Mississippi, the river is too narrow for two barges to pass, so it's one barge at a time. A lot of barges have been forced to go with greatly reduced loads so it allows the barge to sit higher on the water. For example, the Mississippi has dropped so low that at this point the famous American Queen steamboat can no longer safely navigate the river. Now, down south, the Mississippi River has gotten so low that salt water is actually starting to move upriver. Boy, that's bad. Whoa. If you're a farmer and salt water starts coming upstream and it migrates into the soil, you're going to have saline soil, and that's going to kill it or get into one of your aquifers. Salt water and aquifer, you just destroyed your aquifer. Well, now here's the conclusion of this. Is there any happy outcome? Is there some positive news? The answer is no. It's tipping. Remember I said, beware, the tipping points are coming? Well, by this time next year, we may see no traffic, zero, on the Mississippi. That would not be good. I'm Gary Knoll. Now for our commentary on human nature. Over the next 12 months, I intend to write original commentaries that help us look into our psyches a little deeper, to go beyond the stories and the headlines, to go beyond party politics and biases, to go beyond our ideologies to what we are all as human beings. Right now, there are 90 million of us who are baby boomers or seniors. And in part, we're realizing we're no longer teenagers. For the next 16 years, a line of approximately 78 million boomers will begin their exodus from middle age into senior citizen territory. Starting this year, almost 8,000 of us, my boomer generation, will be turning 65 years of age every day, or 330 boomers every hour. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. People in their 40s and 50s are seeing wrinkles, gray hair, and bodies that are not what they used to be. And it's scaring them. They think of where their parents and elders were at the same age, and they remember them being old. Boomers don't feel prepared for that, having devoted their middle age years to the frantic pursuit of securing a future for themselves. Boomers are now waking up to the realization that the joys and vitality of life are passing them by. They're facing their expiration date. From the 1960s, when my generation came of age and started entering the workforce and finding their individual identity in society, to the present, we have fundamentally shaped American culture as we know it today. Every artist knows that there is a direct correlation between the mind and imagination of the artist and what he or she paints on canvas or sculpts in clay. An angry and depressed artist will produce works that emit those emotions to the viewer, and an artist full of joy and inner contentment will transmit a feeling of vibrance and wholesome expansion. A similar parallel can be made to the values, lifestyles, pursuits, and attitudes of our generation and the world we know now into the 21st century. It's important to understand this relationship to better appreciate and comprehend the baby boomer legacy, a trail that I now define an increasing alienation from and confusion about our own authentic self. Although our legacy includes important innovations in science, psychology, social reform, social activism, gender equality, and spirituality, it has likewise contributed to America's current cultural crisis and political theater, and has shaped the nation into a populace that has lost its sense of civic virtue by turning its back on the community and family-based values that were the hallmark of boomer parents. The boomer generation is primarily responsible for our society's descent into social apathy, trivial pursuits, and unhealthy lifestyles. I should make it clear that I am not suggesting that members of the greatest generation, those born between 1911 and 1924, and who served in the Second World War, did not play a significant role in today's age of globalization, consumerism, and multinational corporate dominance. Economists such as Milton Friedman, whose theories of free market economics have essentially shaped the American economy since the Reagan presidency, when Alan Greenspan was first appointed as head of the Federal Reserve, they all belong to that greatest generation. However, the subsequent boomer presidents, Bill Clinton and George Bush, further strengthened the free market economic system. And since the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have been experiencing the rapid promotion of a religion of consumerism, which underlies both the spiritual materialism of New Age thinking and the moralistic notions of the right-wing fundamentalism in American religious systems, at the expense of once vital industries and authentic spiritual altruism that made America the exemplar of the world during the aftermath of the Second World War. My generation entered adulthood between the 1960s and the mid-1980s. They are the generation that wanted to have it all. Indeed, my generation were the first generation that had been led to expect that they could have a superb education, a fulfilling career, a home with all the recent appliances and gadgets, enjoyable relationships, and a family. And while theoretically the generation could have everything, practically, many could not. And many, although they attained all the prizes in the game plan, found that they could not achieve the happiness they had assumed would go with those prizes. They had worked too intensely, made and in some cases lost a lot of money, and in the process burnt themselves out. Now, in the 21st century, we have millions, tens of millions of people who, if not completely demoralized, are walking around with a pervasive sense of unease and uncertainty. They have no energy, no intellectual energy, no spiritual energy, no creative energy, no humanistic energy. How do I know this? Because I just returned from 2 years of intensive travel alone with my camera for a new film that you will see later next year. It is called Poverty Inc., The New Poor. And the vast majority of people I spoke with were between 45 and 90. So I got a full spectrum from thousands and thousands of people of what it means to be them today. And no matter what their station in life, no matter what their economic standing is or was, there's this sense of hollowness, a sense of emptiness, this overwhelming attitude of apathy. They don't know what to believe in, and hence they believe almost nothing. They once had idealism. They once had rebellious expression. Once this generation's historical signature is almost gone. Now many boomers wish they could start over. The good news is that you can, if you're willing. A process of change and real transformation to renew the more positive ideals that once inspired their determination to address the wrongs, prejudices, and erroneous judgments in the American society. Doing so requires actualizing your own self-awareness and synergizing this awareness with positive intentions and actions to improve the lives of others and others' communities. It can no longer be about me, I. It has to be about we. One of the things I enjoy most in my life is helping people reach a point in their lives where they're willing to make necessary changes, which is why I do this program every day. It has been wonderful to hear from people of all ages, from teenagers to octogenarians and beyond, that they can take information, they can take resources, and mold it into something of value in their own consciousness. That then can make a difference in their lives. But in talking to members of the X generation, the baby boomer generation, the Y generation, I've been struck by the fact that so many are dissatisfied about the loss of the authentic purpose of their lives. Especially the older people, these are some of the most well-educated, privileged, and savvy people in the nation. Why, in many cases, haven't they been able to use these assets to make necessary changes and find a measure of contentment? Some have understood intellectually the need to look within and reprioritize their lives, but they've been unable to translate that understanding into meaningful change. They've conscientiously tried to exercise, such as meditating or going on spiritual and health retreats, but their outlooks have not changed. As members of this generation have left youth and advanced into middle age and beyond, many have a feeling of emptiness and continue to search for something they haven't found. The spiritual experiment for seeking self-discovery has been one of the characteristics of the boomer generation. One early statistic estimated that 42% of all baby boomers left their family's religion or faith group. Now, that's a significant figure and indicates how important the pursuit of self-expression has been among boomers. Their adventurous spirit in exploring alternative lifestyles, new modalities of health, different foreign philosophies and religions and art is still influential today. You might think it's been this way for every generation, that every generation undergoes difficulty in finding contentment. I read the work of Cicero. He was arguing at the time about what you would think was just a normal 16-year-old teenager today. That hasn't changed. Everyone has a middle life crisis. But I don't think everyone has been this empty. My generation sacrificed the values and qualities that built America in exchange for lives of superficiality and a vision that focused attention on things that lack any essential meaning. For this reason, I find that this generation is having a particularly rough time recovering what it has lost. The question is why? The baby boomers grew up during a unique time in American history. They may have reached adulthood in this socially tumultuous late 60s and 70s, but people actually absorbed their values in childhood. And for boomers, that was in the 1950s and 60s, a time when conventional values, seemingly reinforced by America's recent victory in World War II and by a growing industrial economy, were stronger than ever. Some conventional values were and remain good, but some assumptions and attitudes prevalent in those days were counterproductive to human fulfillment. My observation is that many boomers still carry around, unquestioningly and even unknowingly, attitudes and assumptions picked up during those years that are now causing them to make repeated mistakes in their personal choices, constant self-sabotage. Later on in my discussions, I will outline some of the more critical mistakes that I see my generation commonly make, and their children, the X generation, make, and then their children, the Y generation, make. We just keep passing it down. Although these are my observations, the important thing is the investigatory process and coming up with answers that are right for you. Now, I'm going to address the boomer generation as a collective group, but on occasion I'll address boomers as individuals, looking at the conditions of their inner lives, because I've interviewed so many. Each, however, mirrors the other. Our inner world shapes the condition of our outer world. If we're angry at ourselves, we will project that anger onto others. The collective of all individual inner worlds, especially when they share the same values and follow the same regimens during their lives, shapes society as a whole. Although we frequently twist ourselves into thinking that our suffering, our alienation, our stress, our depression are solely our own, we also share these problems with everyone we meet, especially our children. It becomes our story that we repeat ad nauseum until it becomes their story. When we have the better part of a nation engulfed in a labyrinth of consumerism and ceaseless selfish pursuits of self-gratification, we ultimately end up with a society of citizens alienated from their authentic selves and from each other. It is my conviction that it is a moral imperative for all of us, young and old and middle-aged, to rekindle the spark that ignited our earlier civic and spiritual ideals and creative activism to reinstate a sense of sanity and balance in American culture. This was the underlying impetus for me to spend time late at night writing this series for you. It is not important that you and I reap the rewards from our actions during our remaining days. Rather, our motivation should be for the benefit of our children and their children, who will ultimately inherit the reins from us to govern and preserve American society in the not-too-distant future. And that completes today's discussion on human nature. It shows you the beginning. Now I will go into depth each day on a different part. I'm going to open our lines now for our talkback segment of our program. The number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. But before we go there, I was stopped this morning on the street as I was going to work and getting some juice, and a fella said, "Gary, I'm thinking about going down to the Republican presidential convention and protesting." And I said, "Are you going to go to the Democratic Democratic presidential campaign and headquarters and protest also?" He said, "Yes, I'm against both." And I said, "But just be aware that you could be arrested." He said, "For what? You can't arrest me." I said, "Yes, they can arrest you." He said, "No, they can." I said, "Are you aware of a law that President Obama passed in secret that's received virtually no attention, where anyone protesting, even holding up a simple sign that says, make a better world for us, not just promise it, that sign, they could put you in jail for a minimum of a year, and you would then be labeled as a felony, get a felony conviction?" Person said, "But we have a First Amendment right. We can protest." I said, "We did. But while the left and the right were asleep, the Patriot Act, the National Defense Authorization Act, all these other acts keep coming along, and they get passed. Now you cannot protest anywhere where there's a Secret Service agent, and the Secret Service agents are everywhere. If you want to protest, let's say, a candidate, if you want to protest the head of a foreign government coming to the United States, you can be arrested. If you just spoke up, if you just stood on a street corner and spoke up and said, 'I don't like your politics, I don't like your policies,' that's enough to have you arrested." And the person said, "I don't believe it." "You don't believe it? You think you got the rights because no one's talked about it? You don't. Obama made sure that now any form of dissent at all, you can be thrown in prison."
"Felony means more than a year in jail. This is not like a traffic ticket. For standing and protesting, the type of thing that for 230 years Americans took for granted because it was protected by the First Amendment, 'Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech,' has actually been abridged by legislation the president signed last Thursday, supported overwhelmingly by both parties, with very, very little public debate and very little debate in Congress. Basically allows Secret Service agents to decide where there are no free speech zones, not speech zones, no free speech zones. And anybody by the Secret Service can, protected by the Secret Service, can ask those agents to ban protests wherever they are. So I can think of three violations: speech violations, association violations, the right to petition the government for a redress of your grievances. What good is free speech if the people in the government are so far away from you that they can't hear you?"
"Judge, what about keeping our elected officials safe?"
"Keeping our elected officials safe is entirely different from insulating them from protest. The fact that the president is going to a hotel up the block should not bar you from standing across the street with a sign or with a bullhorn saying what you think about the president's policies. That is not a threat to him, and it is a part of American history since day one that we have the right to speak freely to, about, and against those in the government."
"Yeah, Judge, you think this is going to be one of those laws that is on the books but not enforced?"
"I think it's one of those laws that's going to be enforced when the government wants it enforced. The problem, Eric, is it puts a lot of unbridled discretion in the hands of Secret Service agents who may very well say, you know what, boss, you've had a rough day. We'll keep everybody away from you. Or, you know what, boss, this crowd likes you, so we're going to let them. We're going to let you hear them. That's suppressing speech on the basis of its content, and that has been expressly prohibited by the First Amendment since day one.
What dictates the Secret Service's presence? In other words, aren't they present all over Washington, D.C.?
Well, they are, and that's a great question, because this law also allows the president to give Secret Service protection to whoever he wants. I'll give you a bizarre example. His campaign managers are coming to Washington to confer with him about the campaign. He can give them Secret Service protection. And then the Secret Service can say to the kids in the streets, you can't shout at David Axelrod, because the campaign manager, because the Secret Service is protecting him. This is a slow, creeping destruction of some of our basic liberties, and the president signed it in secret.
Okay, so that should answer that. So imagine all the people who are going to be protesting as long as there's a Secret Service agent, and there are, for all the candidates, you could be arrested. Whether they will or not is beside the point. And where is the protest? And Democrats and Republicans, by a majority, sign that into law secretly. I'm Gary Nall. Let's take some calls now on our talkback segment of our program. Al from Long Island. Hi, Al. You're on the air.
Hey, I'm calling because you mentioned a few days ago, I think sometime last week, that the U.S. is destabilizing the Middle East in order to get to Moscow. I'd like to know what's in Moscow that they're after.
There's absolutely nothing in Moscow that we could use. Russia is the second largest oil reserve in the world. It has the second largest amount of gold behind China. And 960 metric tons of gold alone for China this year. But it's Russia that supports, through its gas lines and oil lines, fuel for much of Europe and certainly Eastern Europe. We need to have a new Cold War. And so, therefore, we picked a fight with Russia, and we picked a fight by circling Russia, which is completely counterintuitive and counterproductive. Now, who needs this war? The neocons do. Why? Because as long as you continue to feed the public the idea that there's an enormous threat to their well-being, you can continue to give hundreds of billions of dollars to build a phantom jets that we don't need, a new battle cruiser we don't need, and then look at the companies that do the actual work on these. Some of these people have received hundreds of billions of dollars for things that will never be used, never be finished. No one ever follows up. This is the... Ron Paul made a statement, and I did fact-checking on it. And he was absolutely correct. 80% of the government is worthless. Now, that's a hard number to digest. But anyone who would like, I'm putting together a major article, a white paper, on the corruption of our government. Now, I'm for government, but small, effective, that helps the people. I do not like bloated bureaucracies that are accountable to no one, where they can do nothing or have power over people. That is not what I like. I don't like Patriot Acts. I don't like military-industrial complexes. I don't like the Department of Energy that is utterly corrupt. I don't like the Food and Drug Administration. I just did a documentary on it. So when you actually take the time and scholarship, and you look at what we're paying for and what we're getting for it, and at the same time that these people get every dollar they want, and we have 18 million hungry children, we have schools and libraries closing, we're eviscerating important courses and curriculum that kids need, we're expanding the ghettoization of the suburbs, expanding the ghettoization of the urban areas, we have no help for them, we're abandoning in veterans, we're allowing home foreclosures. Where is our priority? And I think it's time that we were honest, and not in a political way, but just in a human way. And then we should take it upon ourselves to put the independent, progressive candidates in positions of power so we could start over and do it right. Get all money out of elections, get all lobbying out of elections, have one single term, 2 years. And until we can do that, all we have is one giant completely gamed system of which we're all victims. So they'll make Russia the big bad Russian bear, and they'll make China an enemy. All the while, China's been paying us billions and billions of dollars a month in giving us loans, $1.7 trillion, so we could carry on with our imperial overdrive in other countries. So look behind the scenes. Find the money trail, and you'll find who's behind making Russia and China an enemy when they're not. Okay, thanks. Let's say hello to Michael from New York City. Hi, Mike. Your turn.
Hi, Gary. Hello?
Yes, hi.
Yeah. Listen, I've been a public advocate of one kind or another for about 57 years, and I do appreciate all the effort you've gone through. It must be kind of frustrating sometime, but I want to say what I told the personal producer, that this morning over National Public Radio, there was this report, very optimistic sounding, that I guess it sounded like we're not to worry. The salt that's creeping up the Mississippi is being tended to by the Army Corps of Engineers and others. You see, they don't seem to think it's a it's something horrible. They haven't don't seem to get it.
They don't. Is this the same? We shouldn't fear anything. Army Corps of Engineers, that the levees won't break it with Katrina. Is that the same Army Corps of Engineers? Is this the same Army Corps of Engineers who chose not to do anything with over 3,300 dikes and levees in the United States, which breached in the last 2 years? That's the same Corps of Engineers, I think, isn't it? One of the most corrupt organizations, worthless organizations in the United States government is the Army Corps of Engineers. Is that the same Army Corps of Engineers that did the Mr. Big, the most devastating environmental catastrophe for that region by drilling a gigantic canal clear around the area so that the oil companies and the gas companies get barges up, yet they didn't do it right, and as a result, when hurricanes come, they use that Mr. Big to expand the tide that goes up and cause devastation to people? Yeah. Well, boy, those are people I wouldn't want on my team. Thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. Let's say hello to Christopher from Queens. Hi, Christopher.
Hey, what's going on, Gary? No, thank you for being a voice of truth in this day and age. Of all these fast food chains and bad food everywhere, how can and people with low incomes, we get sucked into that. How can people on low incomes get away from that and you know, work with finding places that...
Okay, what if I ask you, would you stop and go to neutral and look at it from a little different perspective to see if this helps you? What if they didn't manipulate us? What if we chose them? What if we chose to eat the hamburger, the french fries, the hot dogs, the supersize, all you can eat for $9.95, the junk food, all the while watching our own bodies and our children's bodies becoming toxic dump sites, instead of making the effort, as people who are poor do every day, to join food co-ops, the Park Slope Food Co-op, the Brooklyn Food Co-op, the Jersey Front Food Co-op, the Harlem Food Co-op, where people in that same economically deprived area choose to have legumes and beans that are half the price, but 10 times the nourishment and no downside negative effects. It is cheaper by far to eat healthy than it is to eat processed foods. But that means you have to become willing to do that. So I think we have to stop blaming McDonald's and Walmarts, and we have to stop blaming the women in Bangladesh for making $14 an hour, 14 cents an hour clothes for us. We have to stop blaming the pesticide makers who we go out and buy their pesticide spray on our lawn. We have to stop blaming the politicians left or right as if those are the only two to vote for. We have to stop blaming that there's only Fox and MSNBC to watch. We're responsible for the choices we make each day. And it's no different than my own family, all who chose to make an excuse for why they didn't need to stop smoking until they all died of cancer. I've said it before, I'll say it one last time. We only know the truth of our choices when we reach our destinations. And if that destination is diabetes, bankruptcy, divorce, death, then we've learned nothing. I'm suggesting that we look ahead and say, what do I want my journey and destinations to be? And then only make the choices that allow that to happen. For every person that you tell me will go down the street and eat junk food, I will show you someone who goes to a great challenge to find the place that will give them the healthy food they need. If every single person did the same thing, your argument would have a merit. The fact that there are people and not a few people being healthy, making healthy choices, means it's not about the fast food franchise in and of itself. You have to be willing participants. Think of that, then you decide for yourself. Thank you, Christopher. Luann, your final turn here.
Well, one of the things I'm really impressed with is the fact that your listeners are not only listening, but they're sending me phenomenal information and research. And I know that you've been talking about the effects of Fukushima. And lo and behold, there's an article here that someone sent me that researchers in Japan said they found evidence that radiation from the Fukushima nuclear disaster has caused the mutation of dozens of butterflies, stunted wings, irregularly developed eyes, disfigured antennas, different color patterns. And the scientists have always stood by the claim that insects are very resistant to radiation. So while it was very unexpected, this is just the beginning, and they're acting very surprised. Oh, look at this. We have mutations. And it wasn't just one set of butterflies. The genetic material is being passed on to subsequent generations by the mutant parents. And suddenly, the exclamation, something has gone wrong with the ecosystem in Japan.
Well, it's a little worse than that. The initial butterflies were removed, so subsequent generations of the butterflies had no contact with radiation. All of the subsequent generation of butterflies ended up with deformities, including enlarged eyes and ulcers, shorter wings, etc. But a new report that I am now in the process of confirming shows that there are now, from just the last year and from Fukushima, 37,200 unexplained deaths, or that cannot be explained by normal death patterns, in Japan, and especially around Fukushima. The original figure was 59,000, but then they took out for those that would have died from the tsunami. So now that's the current figure that we're working with that may be tracked up or down. So we're dealing with a lot of people who died, and we're told from radiation, and we're told no one died from radiation. So the truth is coming out finally. I just read that report at 4 o'clock this morning. So thank you for bringing that to our attention. I will be in Japan in a couple weeks. I will be filming there, and I'll be reporting from Japan from different places. And I'm going to be doing measurements of all the food myself, water in all the lakes and streams on the entire island, and sampling all the food, including the so-called organic food. I intend to measure everything, and I'll report back on that. Thank you, Luann.
You're welcome.
I'm Gary Noll. That's all the time we have. Thank you all for listening. Now, stay tuned for Mike Fader, a very popular voice. He'll be with you in just 30 seconds.
I only meant to love you. Didn't you know it, baby? Why couldn't you be content with the love I gave?